on for analysis, and the patient in due course would die, and the body was either burned or sprayed and buried in chemically treated ground. Not this time. He would have in his control, in due course, the largest quantity of the virus ever seen, and from that he would grow more, all virulent, all powerful. He turned. "So, Moody, how did she contract it?" "She was treating the index patient." "The Negro boy?" the director asked, standing in the corner. Moody nodded. "Yes." "What did she do wrong?" "We never found out. I asked her when she was still lucid. She never gave the boy an injection, and Sister was always very careful with sharps." "She's an experienced nurse," Moody reported mechanically. He really was too tired to do much of anything but report what he knew, and that, the director thought, was just fine. "She worked with Ebola before at Kikwit and other places. She taught procedures to staff." "Aerosol transmission?" the director asked. It was too much to hope for. "CDC believes that this is the Ebola Mayinga subtype. You will recall that this strain is named for a nurse who contracted the disease through unknown means." That statement made the director look hard into Moody's eyes. "You're quite sure of what you said?" "I'm not sure of anything at the moment, but I also interviewed staff at the hospital, and all injections were given to the index patient by others, not Sister here. So yes, this may be a case of aerosol transmission." It was a classic case of good news and bad news. So little was known of Ebola Zaire. It was known that the disease could be passed on by blood and other bodily fluids, even by sexual contact. That was almost entirely theoretical, since an Ebola victim was hardly in a position to engage in such practices. It was further believed that the virus fared poorly out of a living host, quick to die in the open. For that reason, it was not believed that the disease could be spread through the air in the manner of pneumonia or other common ailments. But at the same time, every outbreak of the virus produced cases which could not be explained. The unfortunate nurse Mayinga had given her name to a strain of the disease which had reached out to claim her life through an unknown means. Had she lied about something? Or forgotten something? Or had she searched her mind and reported the truth, and thus memorialized a subtype of Ebola which did survive in the air long enough to be transmitted as readily as the common cold? If so, that would make the patient before them the carrier of a biological weapon of such power as to make the entire world shake. Such a possibility also meant that they were quite literally dicing with death himself. The smallest mistake could be lethal. Without conscious thought, the director looked upward at the air-conditioning vent. The building had been designed with that very contingency in mind. The incoming air was all clean, sucked in through a vent located at the end of 200 meters of piping. The air exiting from the hot areas passed through a single plenum chamber before leaving the building. There it was subjected to blazingly powerful ultraviolet lights, since that frequency of radiation destroyed viruses with total reliability. The air filters were soaked with chemicals, phenol was one of them, to achieve the same end. Only then was it ejected to the outside, where other environmental factors also could be depended upon to deny the disease a chance to survive. The filters, three separate banks of them, were changed with religious precision every 12 hours. The UV lights, five times the number required for the task, were constantly monitored. The hot lab was kept at intentionally low ambient air pressure to prevent a leak, and that fact enabled the building to be evaluated for structural integrity. For the rest, he thought, well, that was why they'd all trained so carefully in suit safety and sharps procedures. The director, too, was a physician, trained in Paris and London, but it had been years since he'd treated a human patient. Mainly he'd devoted the last decade to molecular biology, most particularly to the study of viruses. He knew as much as any man about them, though that was little enough. He knew how to make them grow, for example, and before him now was a perfect medium, a human being converted by fate into a factory for the deadliest organism known to man. He'd never known her healthy, had never spoken with her, never seen her at work. That was good. Perhaps she had been an effective nurse, as Mahudi said, but that was all in the past, and there was little point in getting overly attached to someone who would be dead in 3 days, four at the most. The longer the better, though, for the factory to do its work, using this human body for its raw material, as it turned out its product, turning Allah's finest creation into his most deadly curse. For the other question, he'd given the order while Mahudi had been showering. Sister Maria Magdalena had taken to another clean-up area, issued clothing, and left to herself. There she had showered in privacy, wondering as she did so what was going on. Where was she? She was still too confused to be truly afraid, too disoriented to understand. Like Mahudi, she showered long, and the procedure did clear her head somewhat, as she tried to form the right questions to pose. She'd find the doctor in a few minutes to ask what was happening. Yes, that's what she would do, Maria Magdalena thought as she dressed. There was a comfortable familiarity to the medical garb, and she still had her rosary, taken into the shower with her. It was a metal one rather than the formal rosary that went along with her religious habit, the same one given to her when she'd taken her final vows more than 40 years before. But the metal one was more easily disinfected, and she'd taken the time in the shower to clean it. Outside, dressed, she decided that prayer would be the best preparation for her quest for information, and so she knelt, blessed herself, and began her prayers. She didn't hear the door open behind her. The soldier from the security force had his orders. He could have done it a few minutes earlier, but to invade a woman's privacy while nude and bathing would have been a hateful act, and she wasn't going anywhere. It pleased him to see that she was praying, her back to him, plainly comfortable and well-practiced with her devotions. This was proper. A condemned criminal was invariably given the chance to speak to Allah. To deny that chance was a grave sin. So much the better, he thought, raising his 9mm automatic. She was speaking to her God now. And now she was doing so more directly. He decocked the hammer, holstered his weapon, and called for the two orderlies outside to clean up the mess. He'd killed people before, had participated in firing parties for enemies of the state, and that was duty, sometimes distasteful, but duty nonetheless. This one made him shake his head. This time he was sure he'd sent a soul to Allah. How strange to feel good about an execution. Tony Brattano had flown in on a TRW-owned business jet. It turned out that he hadn't yet decided to accept the offer from the Lockheed Martin board, and it was pleasing to Ryan that George Winston's information was incorrect. It showed that he wasn't privy to this particular piece of insider information, at least.
"I've said no before, Mr. President."
"Twice?" Ryan nodded. "To head ARPA, and to be Deputy Secretary for Technology. Your name came up for NRO also, but they never called you about it."
"So I heard,"
Brattano acknowledged. He was a short man, evidently with short man complex, judging by his combativeness. He spoke with the accent of someone from Manhattan's Little Italy, despite many years on the West Coast, and that also told Ryan something. He liked to proclaim who and what he was, this despite a pair of degrees from MIT, where he might as easily have adopted a Cambridge accent.
"And you turned the jobs down because it's a great big clusterfuck over there across the river, right?"
"Too much tail and not enough teeth. If I ran my business that way, the stockholders would lynch me. The defense bureaucracy..."
"So fix it for me," Jack suggested.
"Can't be done."
Don't give me that, Brentano. Anything man can make, he can unmake. If you don't think you have the stuff to get the job done, fine, tell me that, and you can head back to the coast.
Wait a minute.
Ryan cut him off again.
No, you wait a minute. You saw what I said on TV, and I'm not going to repeat it. I need to clean up a few things, and I need the right people to do it. And if you don't have it, fine. I'll find somebody tough enough to...
Tough! Brentano nearly came off his seat.
Tough! I got news for you, Mr. President. My papa sold fruit from a cart on the corner. The world didn't give me shit.
Then he stopped short when Ryan laughed and thought a moment before going on.
Not bad, he said more sedately. In the manner of the corporate chairman, he was.
George Winston says you're feisty. We haven't had a halfway decent sec def in 10 years.
Good.
When I'm wrong, I need people to tell me so. But I don't think I'm wrong about you.
What do you want done?
When I pick up the phone, I want things to happen. I want to know that if I have to send kids into harm's way, they're properly equipped, properly trained, and properly supported. I want people to be afraid of what we can do. It makes life a lot easier for the State Department, the President explained. When I was a little kid in East Baltimore and I saw a cop walking up Monument Street, I knew two things. I knew it wasn't a good idea to mess with him, and I also knew I could trust him to help me if I needed it.
In other words, you want a product that we can deliver whenever we have to.
Correct.
We've drawn down a long way, Brentano said warily.
I want you to work with a good team, you pick it, to draw up a force structure that meets our needs. Then I want you to rebuild the Pentagon to deliver it.
How much time do I have?
I'll give you 2 weeks on the first part.
Not long enough.
Don't give me that. We study things so much I'm surprised the paper all those things are printed on hasn't consumed every tree in the country. Hell, I know what the threats are out there, remember? That used to be my business. A month ago we were in a shooting war, sucking air because we were out of assets to use. We got lucky. I don't want to depend on luck anymore. I want you to clear out the bureaucracy so if we need to do something it gets done. In fact, I want things done before we have to do them. If we do the job right, nobody'll be crazy enough to take us on.
Question is, are you willing to take it on, Dr. Brentano?
It'll be bloody.
My wife's a doc, Jack told him. Half the job's getting good intelligence, Brentano pointed out.
I know that, too. We've already started on CIA. George ought to be okay at Treasury. I'm checking out a list of judges to head justice. I said it all on TV. I'm putting a team together. I want you on it.
I made my way on my own, too. You think two people like us would have got this far anywhere else?
Payback time, Brentano. Ryan leaned back, pleased with himself for the delivery. There was no fighting it, the executive knew.
When do I start?
Ryan checked his watch.
Tomorrow morning suit you?
The maintenance crew showed up just after dawn. The aircraft had a military guard arrayed around it to keep the curious away, though this airport was already more secure than most of its international counterparts because of the Iranian Air Force presence. The crew foreman's clipboard told him what had to be done, and the long list of procedures had him curious, but little else. Aircraft of this type always got special treatment because the people who flew in them deemed themselves the elect of God, or something even higher still. Not that it mattered. He had his procedures, and the advice for extra caution was hardly necessary. His people were always thorough. The aircraft maintenance sheet said that it was time to replace 2 cockpit instruments, and 2 replacements were ready, still in the manufacturer's boxes. Those would have to be calibrated after installation. 2 other members of his crew would refuel the aircraft and change the engine oil. The rest would work on the cabin under the foreman's supervision. They'd scarcely begun when a captain showed up with fresh orders, predictably ones which contradicted the first set. The seats had to be replaced quickly. The G-4 would be taking off in a few hours for another flight. The officer didn't say where to, and the foreman didn't care to ask. He told his instrument mechanic to hurry with his assigned task. That was fairly easy in the G-4 with its modular instrument arrangement. A truck appeared with the seats that had been taken out 2 days earlier, and the cleanup crewman assisted, manhandling them into place before they could properly begin. The foreman wondered why they'd been removed in the first place, but it wasn't his place to ask, and the answer would not have made much sense anyway. A pity everyone was in a hurry. It would have been easier to do the cleaning with so much open space. Instead, the 14-seat configuration was quickly re-established, making the aircraft back into a mini-airliner, albeit a very comfortable one. The replacement seating had been dry-cleaned in the hangar as it always was, the ashtrays emptied and swabbed out. The caterer showed up next with food for the galley, and soon the aircraft was overcrowded with workers, each getting in the other's way. And in the resulting confusion, work was not done properly. But that was not the foreman's fault. Things just accelerated from there. The new flight crew showed up with their charts and flight plans. They found a mechanic lying half on the pilot seat and half on the cabin floor, finishing his work on the digital engine instruments. Never patient with mechanics, the pilot merely stood and glared as the man did his work. For his part, the mechanic didn't care at all what pilots thought. He attached the last connector, wriggled his way free, and ran a test program to make sure it was working properly, without so much as a look at the aviators, who would be sure to curse him all the louder if he failed to install the electronics properly. He'd not yet left the area when the co-pilot took his place and ran the same test program again. Leaving the aircraft to get out of the way, the mechanic saw the reason for the rush. Five of them, standing there on the ramp, looking impatient and important as they stared at the white-painted executive jet, excited about something. The mechanic and everyone else on the crew knew them all by name. They appeared so often on TV. All of them nodded deference to the mullahs and speeded their efforts, as a result of which not everything got done. The cleanup crew was called off the aircraft and limited their efforts to wiping a few surfaces down after getting all the seats reinstalled. The VIP passengers boarded at once, heading to the after portion of the cabin so that they could confer. The flight crew started up, and the guards' force and the trucks hardly had a chance to withdraw before the G-4 taxied off to the end of the runway. In Damascus, the second member of that small executive fleet touched down, to discover that it had orders to return to Tehran at once. The crew swore, but did as they were told, limiting their time on the ground to a scant 40 minutes before lifting off again in their turn for the short hop into Iran. It was a busy time at Palm Bowl. Something was going on. You could tell that by what wasn't going on. Traffic on the encrypted channels used by senior Iraqi generals had peaked and zeroed, then peaked again and zeroed again. At the moment, it was back at zero. Back at KKMC in Saudi Arabia, the computers were grinding through solutions to the chip-controlled scrambling systems used on Iraqi tactical radios. It took time in every case. Encryption technology, once the province only of affluent countries, had, with the advent of personal computers, become readily available to the humblest citizen in America and other technically advanced countries, and an unexpected spin-off of that fact was the current availability of highly advanced communication security apparatus to the humblest nations. Now Malaysia had codes nearly as hard to break as Russia's, and so did Iraq, courtesy of Americans who worried about having the FBI read their fictitious email adulteries. The encryption systems on tactical radios were necessarily somewhat simpler, and still breakable, but even that required a Cray computer that had been flown to the Saudi Kingdom years earlier. Another factor was that Palm Bowl was in Kuwait, and had indeed been fully financed by the local government, for which courtesy a return courtesy was required. they got to see the take from the NSA station. That was only fair. But the NSA and military intelligence personnel hadn't been trained to consider what fair was. They had their orders even so. "They're talking about their families?" a U.S. Air Force sergeant asked himself aloud. That was new. Pombol had tapped into intimate information on this network before, and learned more than a few things about the personal habits of senior Iraqi generals, along with some crude jokes which alternately did and did not translate well into English. But this was a first. "Evac," the chief master sergeant next to him observed, "it's a bug out. Lieutenant," he called, "something happening here." The junior watch officer was working on something else. The radar at Kuwait International Airport was an unusually powerful one, installed since the war, and it operated in two modes, one for the aircraft controllers and another for the Kuwaiti Air Force. It could see a good long way. For the second time in as many days, there was a business jet heading toward Baghdad from Iran. The flight path was identical with the previous trip, and the transponder code was the same. The distance between the two capitals was a mere 400 miles, just enough distance to make it worthwhile for a business jet to climb up to cruising altitude and so make efficient use of its fuel, and, by the way, touch the fringe of their radar coverage. There would be a circling E-3B AWACS around, too, but that reported directly to KKMC and not to Pombol. It was a matter of professional pride for the uniformed spooks at the ground station to beat the airborne people at their own game, all the more so since most of them were themselves USAF personnel. The lieutenant made a mental note of that information, then walked across the room to where the sergeants were. "What is it, Chief?" she asked. The chief master sergeant scrolled his computer screen, showing the translated content of several cracked conversations, tapping his finger on the screen to call attention to the times. "We have some folks getting the hell out of Dodge City, ma'am." A moment later, a Kuwaiti major slid alongside. Ismail Sabah was distantly related to the royal family, Dartmouth-educated, and rather liked by the American personnel. During the war, he'd stayed behind and worked with a resistance group, one of the smart ones. He'd laid low, gathered information on the movement and disposition of Iraqi military units, and gotten it out, mainly using cellular phones which were able to reach into a Saudi civilian network just across the border, and which the Iraqis had been unable to track. Along the way, he'd lost 3 close family members to the Iraqi terror. He'd learned all manner of lessons from the experience, the least of which was a hatred for the country to his north. A quiet, insightful man in his middle 30s now, he seemed to get smarter every day. Sabah leaned in to scan the translations on the computer screen.
"How do you say the rats are leaving the ship?"
"You think so too, sir?" the chief asked, before his lieutenant could. "To Iran?" the American officer asked. "I know it looks that way, but it doesn't make sense, does it?" Major Sabah grimaced.
"Sending their air force to Iran didn't make sense either, but the Iranians kept the fighter planes and let the pilots go home. You need to learn more of the local culture, Lieutenant."
"I've learned that nothing here makes much sense," she couldn't say. "What else do we have?" Sabah asked the sergeant.
"They talk and go quiet, and then they talk some more and go quiet. There's traffic underway now, but KKMC is still trying to crack it."
Radar surveillance reports an inbound from Mehrabad to Baghdad, coded as a business jet.
"Oh, same one as before?" Sabah asked the American lieutenant.
"Yes, Major."
"What else, anything?"
The chief master sergeant handled the answer.
"Major, that's probably what the computers are cooking on right now. Maybe in 30 minutes?"
Sabah lit a cigarette. Pombol was technically a Kuwaiti-owned facility, and smoking was permitted, to the relief of some and the outrage of others. His relatively junior rank did not prevent him from being a fairly senior member of his country's intelligence service,
all the more so that he was modest and businesslike in manner, a useful contrast with his war record, on which he'd lectured in Britain and America. "Opinions?" he asked, already having formed his own.
"You said it, sir. They're bugging out," the Chief Master Sergeant replied.
Major Sabah completed the thought.
"In hours or days Iraq will not have a government, and Iran is assisting in the transition to anarchy."
"Not good," the chief breathed.
"The word catastrophe comes to mind," Sabah observed mildly. He shook his head and smiled in a grim sort of way, earning additional admiration from the American spooks. The Gulfstream landed in calm air after the 65-minute flight in from Tehran, timed by Badrine's watch. As punctual as Swiss air, he noted. Well, that was to be expected. As soon as it stopped, the door dropped open and the five passengers deplaned, to be met with elaborately false courtesy, which they returned in kind. A small convoy of Mercedes sedans spirited them off at once to regal accommodations awaiting them in the city center, where they would, of course, be murdered if things went poorly. Scarcely had their cars pulled off when two generals, their wives, their children, and one bodyguard each, emerged from the VIP terminal and walked to the aircraft. They quickly boarded the G-4. The co-pilot lifted the door back into place, and the engines started up, all in less than 10 additional minutes by Badrine Seiko. Just that fast, it taxied off to make the return flight to Mehrabad International. It was something too obvious for the tower personnel to miss. That was the problem with security, Badrine knew. You really couldn't keep something secret, at least not something like this. Better to use a commercial flight and treat the departing generals as normal passengers on a normal trip. But there were no regular flights between the two countries, and the generals would not have submitted themselves to such plebeian treatment in any case. And so the tower people would know that a special flight had come in and out under unusual circumstances, and so would the terminal employees who'd been required to fawn on the generals and their retinues. For one such flight, that might not be important. But it would matter for the next. Perhaps that was not overly important in the great scheme of things. There was now no stopping the events he had helped to set in motion, but it offended Ali Badrine in a professional sense. Better to keep everything he did secret. He shrugged as he walked back to the VIP terminal. No, it didn't matter. And, through his actions, he'd won the gratitude of a very powerful man in charge of a very powerful country, and for doing no more than talking, telling people what they already knew, and helping them to make a decision which could not have been avoided, whatever their efforts to the contrary. How curious life was.
Same one. Geez, he wasn't on the ground very long.
Through a little effort, the radio traffic for that particular aircraft was isolated and playing in the earphones of an Army Spec 6 language expert. Though the language of international aviation was English, this aircraft was speaking in Farsi. Probably thought a security measure, it merely highlighted that aircraft, tracked by radar and radio direction finders. The voice traffic was wholly ordinary except for that, and for the fact that the aircraft hadn't even been on the ground long enough to refuel. That meant the whole thing was pre-planned, which was hardly a surprise under the circumstances, but enlightening even so. Aloft, over the far northwest end of the Persian Gulf, an AWACS was now tracking the aircraft as well. Interest, cued by Palm Bowl, had perked up enough to move the E-3B off its normal patrol station, now escorted by four Saudi F-15 Eagle fighters. Iranian and Iraqi electronic intelligence troops would take note of this, and know that someone was interested in what was going on, and wonder why, because they didn't know. The game was ever a fascinating one, neither side knowing all it wished, and assuming the other side, at the moment there were actually three sides in the game, knew too much, when in fact none of the three knew much of anything. Aboard the G-4, the language was Arabic. The two generals chatted quietly and nervously in the rear, their conversation masked by engine sounds. Their wives just sat, more nervous still, while the various children read books or napped. It was hardest on the bodyguards, who knew that if anything went wrong in Iran, they could do nothing but die uselessly. One of these sat in the middle of the cabin and found that his seat was wet, with what he didn't know, but it was sticky and red? Tomato juice or something, probably. Annoyed, he went to the lavatory and washed his hands off, taking a towel back to wipe the seat off. He returned the towel to the lav before he reseated himself, then looked down at the mountains and wondered if he'd live to see another sunrise, not knowing that he'd just limited the number to 20.
"Here we go," the chief master sergeant said. That was the vice chief of their air force, and the commanding general of 2nd Iraqi Army Corps, plus families, he added. The decryption had required just over 2 hours from the time the scrambled signal had been copied down.
"Expendables?" the USAF lieutenant asked. She was learning, the other spooks thought.
"Relatively so," Major Sabah agreed with a nod. "We need to look for another aircraft lifting off from Mehrabad soon after this one lands."
"Where to, sir?"
"Ah, Lieutenant, that is the question, is it not?"
Sudan, the chief thought. He'd been in country for 2 years, and it was his second tour at Palm Bowl.
"I would not wager against you on that, Sergeant," Sabah observed with a wink. "We should confirm that through the time cycle of the flights out of Baghdad."
And he really couldn't make a judgment call on the entire exercise until then, though he already had flagged his own superiors that something unusual was afoot. Soon it would be time for the Americans to do the same.
20 minutes later, a preliminary report was on its way from KKMC to Fort Meade, Maryland, where the vagaries of time landed it in the watch center just after midnight. From the National Security Agency, it was cross-decked by fiber-optic cable to Langley, Virginia, into Mercury, the CIA's communications watch facility, then upstairs to the CIA's operations center, room 7F27 in the old headquarters building. At every stop, the information was handed over raw, sometimes with the local assessment, but more often without, or if it were, placed at the bottom so that the national intelligence officers in charge of the various watches could make their own assessments and duplicate the work of others. Mostly this made sense, but in fast-breaking situations it very often did not. The problem was that one couldn't tell the difference in a crisis. The national intelligence officer in charge of the watch at CIA was Ben Goodley, a fast riser in the Directorate of Intelligence, recently awarded his NIO card, along with the worst duty schedule because of his lack of seniority. As usual, he showed his good sense by turning to his area specialist and handing over the printout just as fast as he could read the pages and tear the sheets away from the staple.
"Meltdown," the area specialist said by the end of page 3, which was not unexpected, but neither was it pleasant.
"Doubts?"
"My boy," the area specialist had 20 years on his boss, "they ain't going to tear around a shop."
"Sny?" Goodley asked, meaning a special national intelligence estimate, an important official document meant for unusual situations.
"I think so. The Iraqi government is coming down." It wasn't all that much of a surprise.
"3 days?"
"If that much."
Goodley stood.
"Okay, let's get it drafted."
Chapter 17. The Revival. It is to be expected that important things never happen at convenient times. Whether the birth of a baby or a national emergency, all such events seem to find the appropriate people asleep or otherwise indisposed. In this case, there was nothing to be done. Ben Goodley determined that CIA had no assets in place to confirm the signal intelligence take, and interested though his country was in the region,
there was no action that could be taken. The public news organizations hadn't twigged to this development, and as was often the case, CIA would play dumb until they did. In doing so, the Central Intelligence Agency would give greater substance to the public belief that the news organizations were as efficient as the government in finding things out. It wasn't always the case, but was more frequently so than Goodley would have preferred.
This snigh would be a short one. The substance of it didn't require a great deal of pontificating, and the fact of it didn't take long to present. Goodley and his area specialist took half an hour to draft it. A computer printer generated the hard copy for in-house use, and a modem transmitted it via secure lines to interested government agencies. With that done, the men returned to the operations center.
Golovko was doing his best to sleep. Aeroflot had just purchased 10 new Boeing 777 jetliners for use in its international service to New York, Chicago, and Washington. They were far more comfortable and reliable than the Soviet airliners in which he'd traveled for so many years. But he was less than enthralled with the idea of flying so far on two engines, American-made or not, rather than the usual four. The seats, at least, were comfortable here in first class, and the vodka he'd had soon after takeoff was a premium Russian label. The combination had given him 5.5 hours of sleep until the usual disorientation of travel clicked in, waking him up over Greenland, while his bodyguard next to him managed to remain in whatever dreamland his profession allowed. Somewhere aft, the stewardesses were probably sleeping as well as they could in their folding seats. In previous times, Sergei Nikolaevich knew, it wouldn't have been like this. He would have flown on a special charter with full communications gear, and if something had taken place in the world, he'd be informed just as quickly as the transmission towers outside of Moscow could dot-dash the information out. All the more frustrating was the fact that something was happening. Something had to be. It was always this way, he thought in the noisy darkness. You traveled for an important meeting because you expected something to take place. And then it happened while you were on the move, and if not totally out of touch, then at least denied the chance to confer with your senior aides. Iraq and China. Thankfully, there was a wide separation between the two hotspots. Then Golovko reminded himself that there was a wider separation still between Washington and Moscow, one which lasted about as long as an overnight flight on a twin-engine aircraft. With that pleasant realization, he turned slightly and told himself that he'd need all the sleep he could get. The hard part wasn't getting them out of Iraq. The hard part would be getting them from Iran to Sudan. It had been a long while since flights from Iran had been allowed to overfly the Saudi kingdom, and the only exceptions were the pilgrimage flights into Mecca during the annual Hajj. Instead, the business jet had to skirt around the Arabian Peninsula, then up the Red Sea before turning west to Khartoum, tripling both time and distance on the delivery leg of the process, and the next short flight couldn't begin until the first long one had arrived in Africa, and the VIPs had arrived at their hastily prepared quarters, and found them satisfactory, and made a phone call with the inevitable code word confirming that all was well. It would have been so much easier had it been possible to load them all onto a single airliner for a single Baghdad-Tehran-Khartoum cycle. But that wasn't possible. Neither was it possible to take the far shorter air routing directly from Baghdad to Khartoum through the simple expedient of overflying Jordan. But that meant passing close to Israel, not a prospect to make the Iraqi generals happy. And then there was the secrecy issue, too, to make things inconvenient. A lesser man than Daryai would have found it enraging. Instead, he stood alone at the window of a closed portion of the main terminal, watching the G-4 stop alongside another, watching the doors open, watching the people scurry down one staircase and immediately onto another, while baggage handlers transferred what few belongings they'd brought along. Doubtless jewels and other items of high value and portability, the holy man thought, without a smile. It took only a few minutes, and then the waiting aircraft started moving.
It was foolish, really, to have come down just to see something so pedestrian and tedious as this. But it represented fully 2 decades of effort. And, man of God though he was, Mahmud Haji Daryai was still human enough to want to see the fruits of his labor. A lifetime had gone into this, and even so it was a task not even half done. And his time was running out. As it was for every man, Daryai reminded himself, 1 second, 1 minute, 1 hour, 1 day at a time. The same for all. But somehow it seemed to run faster when one was over 70 years of age. He looked down at his hands, the lines and scars of a lifetime there, some natural, some not. 2 of his fingers had been broken while a guest of Savak, the Shah's Israeli-trained security service. He remembered the pain of it. He remembered even better the reckoning with the 2 men who'd interrogated him. Daryai hadn't spoken a word. He'd just looked at them, stood there like a statue, as they were taken off to the firing squad. Not very much satisfaction in it, really. They'd been functionaries, doing a job assigned to them by others, without really caring who he was or why they were supposed to hate him. Another mullah had sat with each in turn to pray with them, because to deny anyone a chance to reconcile himself with Allah was a crime. And what did it hurt? They died just as quickly that way as any other. 1 small step in a lifetime's journey, though theirs had ultimately been far shorter than his. All the years spent for his single-minded purpose, Khomeini had taken his exile in France, but not Daryai. He'd remained in the background, coordinating and directing for his leader. Picked up that one time, he'd been let go because he hadn't talked, nor had anyone close to him. That had been the Shah's mistake, one of many. The man had ultimately succumbed to indecision. Too liberal in his policies to make the Islamic clergy happy, too reactionary to please his Western sponsors, trying vainly to find a middle ground in a part of the world where a man had only 2 choices. Only 1, really, Daryai corrected himself as the Gulfstream jet lifted off. Iraq had tried the other path, away from the Word of God. And what had it profited them? Hussein had started his war with Iran, thinking the latter country weak and leaderless, and achieved nothing. Then he had struck out to the south and accomplished even less, all in the sole quest for temporal power. It was different for Daryai. He'd never lost sight of his goal, as Khomeini had not. And though the latter was dead, his task lived on. His objective lay behind him as he faced north, too far to see. But there even so, in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and Jerusalem. He'd been to the 1st 2, but not the 3rd. As a boy, young and pious, he'd wanted to see the Rock of Abraham, but something, he didn't remember what, had prevented his merchant father from taking him there. Perhaps in time. He'd seen the city of the Prophet's birth, however, and of course made the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj, more than once, despite the political and religious differences between Iran and Saudi Arabia. He wished to do so again, to pray before the veiled Kaaba. But there was more to it than that, even. Titular chief of state, he wanted more. Not so much for himself. No, he had a larger task at the bottom of his humble life. Islam stretched from the extreme west of Africa to the extreme east of Asia, not counting the small pockets of the faith's adherents in the Western Hemisphere. But the religion had not had a single leader and a single purpose for over 1,000 years. It caused Daryai pain that this should be so. There was but 1 God and 1 word, and it must have saddened Allah that his word was so tragically misunderstood. That was the only possible reason for the failure of all men to grasp the true faith. And if he could change that, then he could change the world and bring all of mankind to God. But to do that... The world was the world, an imperfect instrument with imperfect rules for imperfect men. But Allah had made it so, and that was that. Worse, there were those who would oppose everything he did, believers and unbelievers both. Another cause more for sadness than for anger. Daryai didn't hate the Saudis and the others on the far side of the Persian Gulf. They were not evil men. They were believers, and despite their differences with him and his country, they'd never be denied access to Mecca. But their way wasn't the way, and that couldn't be helped. They'd grown fat and rich and corrupt, and that had to be changed. Daryai had to control Mecca in order to reform Islam. To do that meant acquiring worldly power. It meant making enemies. But that wasn't new, and he'd just won his first major battle. If only it didn't take so long. Daryai often spoke of patience, but his was the work of a lifetime, and he was 72, and he didn't want to die as his mentor had, with the work not even half done. When there came his moment to face Allah, he wanted to speak of accomplishment, of successfully fulfilling the noblest task any man could have, the reunification of the true faith. And Daryai was willing to do much for that goal. He himself didn't even know how much it was that he was willing to undertake, because not all the questions had yet been asked. And because his goal was so pure and bright, and his remaining time so short, he'd never asked himself how deeply he would cross into darkness in order to get there. Well, he turned away from the window and walked off with his driver to the car. The process had begun. People in the intelligence community are not paid to believe in coincidences, and these particular people had maps and watches to predict them. The unrefueled range of the G4 was well known, and the distances to be covered were easily computed. The circling AWACS aircraft established a track heading south from Tehran. Transponder settings told them the type of aircraft, along with speed, heading, and altitude, the last being 45,000 feet for maximum fuel efficiency. Timing was checked between one such flight and another. The course told them even more. Sudan, Major Sabah confirmed. It could have gone elsewhere. He almost thought that Brunei was a possible option. But no, that would be too far from Switzerland. And Switzerland was where the money was. Had to be. With that judgment, a satellite signal was sent to America, again to CIA, and this one occasioned waking a senior DO official up merely to say yes to a brief question. The answer was relayed back to Palm Bowl out of courtesy to the Kuwaitis. Then it was just a matter of waiting. The CIA had a small presence in Khartoum, really just a station chief and a couple of field officers and a secretary whom they shared with the NSA-run signal section. The station chief was a good one, however, who had recruited a number of local citizens to act as agents. It helped that the Sudanese government had little to hide, most of the time, too poor to be of interest as much of anything. In previous times, the government had used its geographic location as a ploy to play east against west, garnering cash and weapons and favor out of the bargain. But the USSR had fallen, and with it, the great power game which had sustained the Third World for two generations. Now the Sudanese had to depend on their own resources, which were slim, and the few crumbs tossed their way by whichever country had transitory need for what little they had. The country's leaders were Islamic, and in proclaiming it as loudly as they could lie, they were no more devout than their Western counterparts, they managed to get aid from Libya and Iran and others, in return for which they were expected to make life hard on the pagan animists in the southern part of the country, plus risk a rising Islamic political tide in their own capital. People who knew the real level of devotion of the country's leaders and wanted to replace them with people who truly believed. On the whole, the political leaders of that impoverished nation thought it was easier to be religious and rich than religious and poor. What that meant to the American embassy personnel was great unpredictability. Sometimes Khartoum was safe when the fundamentalist troublemakers were under control. Sometimes it was not, because they were not. At the moment, the former seemed to be the case, and all the American Foreign Service officers had to worry about were the environmental conditions, which were vile enough to place this post in the bottom 10 of global embassy assignments even without a terrorist threat. For the station chief, it meant early advancement, though his wife and two children remained home in Virginia, because most of the official American residents didn't feel safe enough to set up their families here. Almost as bad, AIDS was becoming a threat sufficient to deny much in the way of nightlife to them, not to mention the question of getting safe blood in the event of an injury. The embassy had an army doctor to handle those issues. He worried a lot. The station chief shook that off. He'd jumped a whole pay grade on taking this assignment. He'd performed well, with one especially well-placed agent in the Sudanese Foreign Ministry to inform America about everything that country did. That his country didn't do all that much was not important to the desk-sitters at Langley. Better to know everything about nothing than nothing about everything. He'd handle this one himself.
Checking time and distance against his own maps, the station chief had an early lunch and drove off to the airport, only a few miles out of town. Security there was African casual, and he found a shady spot outside. It was easier to cover the private terminal than the public one, especially with a 500mm lens on his camera. He even had time to make sure he had the aperture right. A buzz on his cellular phone from the NSA people at the embassy confirmed that the inbound aircraft was on final, a fact further verified by the arrival of some official-looking cars. He'd already memorized two photographs faxed to him from Langley. Two senior Iraqi generals, eh? He thought. Well, with the death of their boss, it wasn't all that surprising. The problem with the dictatorship business was that there wasn't much of a retirement plan for any of those near the top of it. The white business jet floated in with the customary puffs of rubber smoke. He locked the camera on it and shot a few frames of high-speed black and white to make sure the motor drive worked. The only worry now was whether the bird would stop in such a way that he could cover the exit with the camera. The bastards could always face the wrong way and spoil the whole thing for him. In that he had little choice. The Gulfstream stopped. The door dropped open, and the station chief started shooting frames. There was a middle-level official there to do the semi-official greeting. You could tell who was important by who got the hugs and kisses, and from the sweep-around look they gave the area. Click, click. He recognized one face for sure, and the other was a probable hit. The transfer took only a minute or two. The official cars pulled off, and the station chief didn't much care where they were heading at the moment. His agent in the Foreign Ministry would fill that one in. He shot the remaining 8 frames of the aircraft, already being refueled, and decided to wait to see what it would do. 30 minutes later, it lifted off yet again, and he headed back to the embassy. While one of his junior people handled the developing, he made a call to Langley. Confirmation, Goodley said, approaching the end of his watch. 2 Iraqi generals touched down at Khartoum 50 minutes ago. It's a bug-out. Makes the Snai look pretty good, Ben, the area specialist observed, with a raised eyebrow. I hope they pay attention to the timestamp on it. The National Intelligence Officer managed a smile. Yeah, well, the next one has to say what it means. The regular analysts, just starting to arrive for a day's work, would fiddle around with that. Nothing good. But you didn't need to be a spook to figure that one out. Photos coming in, a communications officer called. The first call had to go to Tehran. Daryai had told his ambassador to make things as clear as possible. Iran would assume responsibility for all expenses. The best possible accommodations were to be provided, with every level of comfort that the country could arrange. The overall operation would not cost a great amount of money, but the savages in that country were impressed by small sums, and $10 million American dollars, a pittance, had already been transferred electronically to ensure that everything went well. A call from the Iranian ambassador confirmed that the first pickup had gone properly and that the aircraft was on its way back. Good. Now, perhaps, the Iraqis would begin to trust him. It would have been personally satisfying to have these swine eliminated, and that would not have been difficult to arrange under the circumstances. But he'd given his word, and besides, this wasn't about personal satisfaction. Even as he set the phone down, his air minister was calling in additional aircraft to expedite the transfer. This was better done quickly. Badrine was trying to make the same point. The word was going to get out, probably in one day, certainly no more than two. They were leaving people behind who were too senior to survive the coming upheaval, and too junior to merit the solicitude the Iranians were willing to show the generals. Those officers, colonels and brigadiers, would not be overly happy at the prospect of becoming the sacrificial goats necessary to assuage the awakening rage of the mob. This fact was becoming clear. But instead of making them more eager to leave, it emerged as a non-specific fear that made all the other fears loom larger in the unknown darkness ahead. They stood on the deck of a burning ship off an unfriendly shore, and they didn't know how to swim all that well. But the ship was still afire. He had to make them grasp that. It was routine enough by now that Ryan was becoming used to it, at home with it, even comfortable with the discreet knock on the door, more startling in its way than the clock radio which had begun his days for 20 years. Instead, his eyes opened at the muted knock, and he rose, put on his robe, walked the 20 feet from the bed to the door, and got his paper, along with a few sheets of his daily schedule. Next he headed to the bathroom, and then to the sitting room adjoining the presidential bedroom, while his wife, a few minutes behind him, started her wake-up routine. Jack missed the normality of merely reading the paper, though it wasn't nearly as good, usually, as the intelligence documents waiting on the table for him. The Washington Post also covered things whose interest was not strictly governmental, and so was fuel for his normal desire to keep abreast of things. But the first order of business was a SNI, an urgent official document stapled inside a manila folder. Ryan rubbed his eyes before reading it. Damn. Well, it could have been worse, the president told himself. At least this time they hadn't awakened him to let him know about something he couldn't change. He checked the schedule. Okay, Scott Adler would be in to discuss that one, along with that Vasco guy. Good. Vasco seemed to know his stuff. Who else today? He skimmed down the page. Sergei Golovko? Was that today? Good luck for a change. Brief press conference to announce Tony Brentano's appointment as SecDef, with a list of possible questions to worry about, and instructions from Arnie. Ignore the Keelty question as much as possible. Let Keelty and his allegations die from apathy. Oh, yeah, that's a good one-liner, Jack coughed as he poured some coffee. Getting himself the right to do that alone had entailed direct orders. He hoped the Navy mess stewards didn't take it as a personal insult, but Ryan was used to doing some things for himself. Under the current arrangement, the stewards set up breakfast in the room and let the Ryans serve themselves, while others hovered in the corridor outside. Morning, Jack. Kathy's head appeared in his view. He kissed her lips and smiled. Morning, honey. Is the world still out there? She asked, getting her own coffee. That told the president that the First Lady wasn't operating today. She never touched coffee on a surgery day, saying that she couldn't risk the slight tremor that caffeine might impart to her hands when she was carving up somebody's eyeball. The image always made him shudder, even though she mainly operated with lasers now. Looks like the Iraqi government is falling. A female snort. Didn't that happen last week? That was Act 1. This is Act 3. Or maybe Act 4.